Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present to you Martin A. Lee, the author of the vitally important The Beast Reawakens, just issued in hardcover in the summer of 1997 by Little Brown Books. Martin, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you, David.
In our last half-hour segment, we were speaking about the mainstreaming of fascism, and we were talking about a theme that has been used very successfully by fascist elements that are moving into the mainstream, namely an anti-immigrant and xenophobic orientation. We've talked about it in Europe. We've talked about it in connection with people like Jörg Haider, some of the neo-Nazi parties in Germany, and Helmut Kohl, and Front National of Jean-Marie Le Pen. This is also a theme that we're seeing on the American far right as well.
Certainly we saw it in Patrick Buchanan's campaign for the Republican nomination for president in 1996. Buchanan, I think, is really the standard bearer for the so-called Christian patriot subculture in the United States, which probably has about 5 million adherents, maybe more, who identify with that framework. The U.S. militia movement is the armed wing of the Christian patriot movement. Certainly Buchanan is a hero to the militia movement as well. But I think the kind of things that Buchanan was saying in the last campaign, like, listen, Jose, you can't come across the border anymore, referring to Latin Americans trying to enter the United States. That kind of anti-immigrant message, if you heard it 15 years ago, would have been seen as so far, you know, out of touch, so far beyond the pale, it would have been seen as sort of right-wing nuttiness. And yet things have shifted so dramatically in terms of the political landscape in the United States, particularly after the end of the Cold War, that those kind of nutty anti-immigrant xenophobic statements are now considered just accepted wisdom by Republicans and Democrats alike in the United States. Not necessarily all Republicans and Democrats, but many, certainly the mainstream of both parties. That's not just something you just really can't be for immigration or increasing immigration. That would be considered political suicide now in the United States. And to me, it's emblematic of the extent to which the extreme right in this country has been able to influence the mainstream and tug it its way.
Here in California, we had something passed a few years ago called Proposition 187. Now it's being kicked around in the courts. This is an anti-immigrant bill, specifically directed at Latin American immigrants in the United States. That bill was co-authored by a lobbyist for the Federation for American Immigration Reform, an organization that has gotten $1 million in funding from an institution that you talk about in The Beast Reawakens, something called the Pioneer Fund.
Yes, the Pioneer Fund has been correctly identified by the British Daily Telegraph as a neo-Nazi political foundation operating in the United States for many years. Its origin goes back to the Third Reich period, when it was founded by supporters of Hitler's eugenics policy, the idea that you can craft a superior master race through selective breeding and so forth. This was an idea promoted by the Pioneer Fund in its early days. After eugenics as a so-called science was badly discredited when the war ended and the horrific concentration camp medical experiments were exposed, then the Pioneer Fund quieted down a bit but continued to promote the idea that the white race was genetically superior to blacks and so forth. And they did this by funding pseudoscientific research into race and genetics and intelligence. They funded various so-called scholars or academics in North America. People like Roger Pearson were very instrumental in promoting this eugenicist views after World War II. Roger Pearson became the editor of Mankind Quarterly, an influential publication within neo-Nazi circles, at least for the so-called more intelligent Nazis, the intellectual racists. And Pearson, in turn, was closely allied with the Liberty Lobby based in Washington, D.C.
Also the World Anti-Communist League.
Yes, he was actually the head of the World Anti-Communist League in 1978, a period of time in which the World Anti-Communist League was really filled to the brim with Nazis and fascist collaborators and death squad elements from Latin America. I mean, it was really just a cesspool of a political depravity that World Anti-Communist League really was at that time. It went through somewhat of a facelift, WACL as it's called, when the Reagan administration took over and they saw fit to use elements or networks tied into the World Anti-Communist League to promote covert operations in Latin America, in Central America in particular, the war against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Also, Wacko figured prominently in the war in Southwest Asia against the Soviet-backed government in Afghanistan. So it went through a partial facelift, but really still many of these elements were tied in with Wacko. Pearson himself left the organization and went on to work with the Heritage Foundation, which was sort of a mainstay for the Reagan administration as a think tank, a policy-making think tank. And he had a short tenure with the Heritage Foundation, then moved on to other things. These days he edits something called the Conservative Review, I believe it's called, and he's still tied in with promoting this sort of racialist conception of world affairs. But the Pioneer Fund is, it's quite striking, to come back to your original point, David, about the Pioneer Fund's link to their organization, FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform. That organization in and of itself is not necessarily a white supremacist or a neo-Nazi organization, but the fact they knowingly took $1 million from a neo-Nazi foundation is quite disturbing, and it underscores again how neo-Nazis have been able to influence the political debate and discussion in the United States through careful placement of funds and monies and in other ways to sort of veer the discussion in a desired direction. And in the course of the anti-immigrant debate and the way that's been used by mainstream politicians in the United States to gain favor among people is, you know, it underscores the influence that neo-Nazis can have, even though they may be a numerical small minority. The Pioneer Fund is a real striking example of this.
One of the bibliographical sources that you access, The Nazi Connection by Stefan Kuhl, a German graduate student who did some marvelous work on the American-German eugenics connection, talks about the Pioneer Fund at considerable length, and the people associated with the Pioneer Fund, such as Harry Laughlin, actually not only influenced the Third Reich's racial legislation, but also had honoraria conferred on them by the Nazi-dominated academe.
Yes, and they also influenced, Laughlin and his colleagues influenced a U.S. Law as well to tighten immigration, to restrict the immigration of Jews during the Third Reich period into the United States, which resulted in the deaths of who knows how many people. But they were very influential in influencing Congress to just tighten the screws and keep the door shut at a time when they needed to be open to save people's lives.
Kuhl points out that in Mein Kampf, Hitler cites the U.S. Immigration Restriction Act of 1924 as a model piece of legislation to ensure the, quote, racial purity, unquote, of a society. Speaking of the Pioneer Fund, Martin, that figures very prominently in the background of an academic work which has emerged in the forefront of, it became a bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list, and this book has emerged into popularity as Newt Gingrich's conservative revolution, as he calls it, has been gathering steam in the United States. That book is The Bell Curve.
Yes, Bell Curve by Murray and Herrnstein. And this was a book, incidentally, supported by the American Enterprise Institute, which is a think tank based in Washington, D.C., supported by many Fortune 500 companies. So this is not, again, this is not a neo-Nazi think tank, or far from it. It's really the quintessential, you know, cream of the American business crop that's involved here. And they supported Murray and Herrnstein's Bell Curve. And I think the fact that a book which promoted the idea, again, revived the discredited idea that black people are inherently genetically inferior in terms of their intelligence compared to whites, that a book could gain that kind of popularity, I think underscores the significance of the changes in the political landscape that ensued with the ending of the Cold War. Because during the Cold War, anti-communism was the glue that held the right wing together in the United States. I mean, it really held everything together politically in the United States. Even if you're a liberal, if you're a right, far right, any shade of opinion in that sense, within that context, one thing you shared was anti-communism. You may have had different ideas about how to respond to the so-called communist menace, but anti-communism was a given. If you were to stand up at a bully pulpit and run for office and say you're pro-communist, no one would vote for you. So anti-communist is just the a priori in American politics during the Cold War. And I think what happened is elements of the racialist right, the white supremacist Nazi right in the United States, used the banner of anti-communism to obscure some of their own political views so that publications like The Spotlight, put out by the Liberty Lobby, which is certainly in the racialist white supremacist camp, would go around saying things or attacking Reverend Martin Luther King, our most gifted civil rights leader during the 1960s, not because he was a leader of the civil rights movement, because he was allegedly a communist. So the racialist theme sort of took a back seat to anti-communism. But once the Cold War ends, anti-communism is no longer the glue that can hold things, all these different factions together in the right wing of the American political scene. And so that racialist theme begins to reemerge again, become more prominent. I think the bell curve is an example of that, how that happened. And certainly the Pioneer Fund is crucial again by putting money where it counted. If you look at the sources, the bibliographical sources and the footnotes for that book, you'll find many figures within this pseudo-scholarly scene, this academic scene, who had been funded themselves by the Pioneer Fund, and who got money to pursue this kind of research and promote these views that were then quoted and footnoted at length in the bell curve. And what was striking again to me is that mainstream publications in the United States, like Newsweek and the Wall Street Journal, were embracing this book and saying this is a fantastic book, The Bell Curve, and citing its research as quintessentially mainstream, unknowingly apparently, without any regard for the fact or just oblivious to the fact that the sources on which it's based have been poisoned by money from the Pioneer Fund and by these really crackpot figures in academia who were promoting these ideas for many years. It was really the bell curve that sort of revived this and made this somewhat respectable again.
And the eugenics orientation of the Third Reich's laws ultimately led to their extermination program. So perhaps we should bear in mind what lies at the end of this, or what previously had been at the end of this particular intellectual rainbow, so to speak, or intellectual road. We spoke in the last half-hour segment about how Helmut Kohl had co-opted the political agenda of many of the far-right and Nazi parties, such as the Republikaner Party, headed up by former SS officer Franz Schoenhuber. Many American fascists and white supremacists have made similar observations about the program of the Republican Party under people like George Bush and Newt Gingrich, David Duke among them.
Yes, well, David Duke is a parallel here because he is someone who started out as a young man wearing the swastika around his arm. He became one of the main leaders of the Ku Klux Klan in the United States. He was very close with the Liberty Lobby. In fact, they helped launch his foray into mainstream politics in the United States. But it was in 1989 that in 1 year, following what was called a tripartite strategy promoted by the Liberty Lobby, Duke started out by running for, it was actually in 1988, he starts out running for the presidential nomination in the Democratic Party. Of course, he had no chance at that. then he became the leader of the ticket of the Populist Party, which was a political party, a third party, so to speak, launched by the Liberty Lobby. Obviously, that didn't have much of a chance of winning. But within the same year, he then switches to the Republican Party, the idea being try any party, Republican, Democratic, or third party, whatever will work, and he gains access to, he gained some success in that 1989 he was elected as a Republican state representative in Louisiana. He never changed his political views, but he went on to run a very serious race for governor of Louisiana, actually and first senator, then governor. In 1991 he ran for governor. He won a majority of the white vote in Louisiana, but he ultimately lost the election. And I think this was really proof to many extreme rightists and Nazis and fascists in the United States, that if you mainstream your message like Duke did, if you wear the right hairstyle, the right surgically enhanced smile, and you make your rhetoric sound very much like Republican mainstream rhetoric, which was very easy for Duke to do, then you had a real chance of making headway in the political process. And one of the very striking things about Duke is that his campaign for the governor of Louisiana in 1991 was supported by the Christian Coalition led by Pat Robertson.
One of the things that we should perhaps bear in mind as we examine the success that people like David Duke have had by taking what had previously been a right-wing extremist and outright fascist message and mainstreaming it is that the Republican Party itself, in its ethnic outreach committee, actually has a repository of Third Reich collaborators and veterans, which has been discussed by many authors, such as Russ Ballant in his remarkable book, The Old Nazis, the Republican Party, The Old Nazis, the New Right, and the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's very significant. These are elements that came over to the United States, diehard fascist collaborators who ended up insinuating themselves into the Republican Party and became crucial players within the ethnic outreach division. This was resulted in a minor scandal. It ought to have been a major scandal in 1988 when Bush was running for president. It was quite embarrassing for Bush, but it was one of those, you know, one or two day wonders in the news where it then became swept under the rug after Bush sort of went through the obligatory motions and a few people were fired, a minor house cleaning or a facelift, but then things kept going as they were. There's still these elements that were continuing to promote their extremist political views within the Republican Party. But I think one of the reasons that Duke was able to be successful and was able to sound just like a mainstream Republican was that instead of promoting overtly white supremacist views, overtly neo-Nazi views, as part of this process of mainstreaming his message, he began to emphasize culture rather than race. He began to talk like this. He would say, all people should be proud of their heritage. Black people should be proud of theirs. White people should be proud of theirs. You know, and on the surface, that's a very difficult thing to disagree with that statement. Although when it's coming from someone like David Duke, given what we know about his past and his present for that matter, it takes on a very, very sinister overtone. But it became much more difficult for people who were, you know, just sort of the mainstream regular Jane and John Doe to see, well, what's wrong with this guy? If he's saying things like that, it sounds good to me. They were, easily able to recognize extremism if a person was wearing the Klan outfit, but not if he began to talk in this slick way that Duke was doing. And I think this was very, very crucial in terms of his success, because if indeed, you know, he stood up there again with the swastika, very few people would have voted for him. But by adopting the rhetoric of the Republican Party, which had this sort of racist undertone anyway, he was able to have a great deal of success.
Bearing in mind Roger Griffin's super virus metaphor for fascism, a couple of other American fascists who've, they might perhaps disagree with that term, but I think it's accurate, who have also enjoyed a measure of success by toning down their Christian identity rhetoric and masquerading or metamorphosing perhaps into, quote, Christians, unquote, people like the Reverend Pete Peters and John Trockman.
Yes, well, Peters, my God, I mean, geez. Yeah, Peters is one of the leaders of the Christian identity movement. And,
which is what, Marty? Explain that briefly.
Christian identity is basically sort of a Nazified perversion of Christianity. It's the theology, if you will, that sort of unites the white supremacist movement in the United States. There are two major camps of Christian identity. Many different churches subscribe to this, you know, within the far-right or extreme-right neo-Nazi scene. But within Christian identity, sort of splits two ways. One of those like in the Aryan nations in Idaho, where they still flaunt the swastika, they still have the pictures of Hitler in their church, and they're overtly neo-Nazi. Others like Pete Peters and John Trockman, who is now the head of the militia of Montana, he founded the organization, one of the key leaders of the entire militia movement, they took a different tack, and they said, wait a minute, if we want to make headway here, we do need to mainstream our message. Let's take the swastikas off the armband, let's take the sheets off our heads, and let's cloak our message in terms of Jesus Christ and the Bible. So that's the way they cloak their hatred in Jesus Christ and the Bible. And that's, I think, the more effective form, at least in terms of relating to the mainstream in the United States, of Christian identity, the ones that chose to go that latter route as outlined by Trockman and Pete Peters. But Pete Peters, I just read a recent report saying how he took a yarmulke, that's you know, the little hat that Jewish worshippers wear in a synagogue, and he held one up at a recent conference in Canada, and he wiped his air, threw it down, and spit on it, you know. So Peter, he is also a person who calls for killing of all homosexuals, claiming that the Bible justifies this. He's a very extreme character, and it's very disturbing when you consider some of his sermons air on the Keystone Network, which is something you can access on you know, through any satellite television or oftentimes any cable channel, along with less virulent figures on the religious right, those that aren't a part of the white supremacist scene. But the fact that they're mixing together is emblematic of a development that's quite disturbing in and of itself. This recent beginning of an overlapping between the white supremacist scene, the racialist right, and the religious right in the United States.
One of the phenomena that I would like to discuss at greater length when we have more time, that is the entire situation vis-a-vis the militias. I think that the militias themselves are something of a mixed bag. I think there are many people within these organizations who are sincerely democratic with a small d instincts, however, extremely badly and misinformed in the most cases. And also, however, there are obviously fascist elements within the militias, which most of the militia groups at least don't seem to be taking stock of, or at least the ones that are getting publicity. One of the things that I think, one of the points that you make that I think is very important and that needs to be discussed is that the militias and the Patriots networks are seen as somehow a phenomenon that is apart from the Republican Party. And yet you point out that actually there is a very strong element of political continuity between those two phenomena.
Yes, yeah, so I would suggest actually that you know, we should do a whole show sometime just on the militias. It would really be worthwhile. There's plenty to cover there.
Let's do that. I also think that an area that plays in here is the whole issue of, quote, conspiracy theory, unquote, because there's a lot of legitimate research that has been disowned to a certain extent by the progressive sector, and I think that actually plays into the hands to a certain extent of some of the fascist elements within the militias and Patriots networks. But that's a longer subject. We'll have to get into that at greater length. But I would like to do an entire show on that. But again, the continuity between the militias and Patriots networks and the Republican Party.
Well, there's a thematic continuity in terms of this anti-big government rhetoric that you find in someone like Gingrich, but in the most extreme case, in people like John Trockman of the Militia Montana and the whole militia movement, where you have these really fanatical anti-government conspiratology that they're promoting in the worst sense of the word, you know, embracing these very paranoid ideas about what the government is allegedly doing to people in the United States. And these ideas are largely without merit, although there is some kernel of truth. You know, we could see what happened in Waco and Ruby Ridge, where the government clearly not only violated people's rights, but killed people in a way that should never have happened.
Sure.
But the there's also a personnel continuity, where it's not just the Republican Party, incidentally. Even people like James Traficant, who's a Democrat, who I think I'd place as among the relatively small group of politicians that have direct ties to the militia movement. People like Helen Chenoweth in Idaho, who really, you know, will appear at militia meetings, who considers militia members her constituency, who advocates for their beliefs, who will urge her congressional colleagues to take seriously this idea of the black helicopters coming in and that they should be investigated and so forth and so on. So you do find several individuals who are both in Congress and in state governments or in state in state governments, and whether state representatives or senators, particularly in the western states, who have these ties to the militia movement. So there is that kind of continuity. It's mainly a Republican thing, but you find a few examples of Democrats as well.
One of the things that we will get into at greater length in connection, I think, with our interview just about the militia movement would be the Oklahoma City bombing. Real quickly, Andrea Strassmeyer and Tim McVeigh.
Very interesting. Andrea Strassmeyer was a German neo-Nazi who had very high-powered political connections back home. His father was one of the right-hand men of the Chancellor of Germany today. Father Gunther Strassmeyer was the de facto chief of staff for Chancellor Helmut Kohl. Well, Strassmeyer himself, Andreas now, the son, is the head of security and in charge of paramilitary training for Elohim City, a Christian identity neo-Nazi enclave in the backwoods of Oklahoma. It is there that Timothy McVeigh called a couple of weeks before the Oklahoma City bombing and is alleged to have asked to speak to Andreas Strassmeyer. There's no doubt the two men had met, both have admitted it. But there's a very interesting story around Strassmeyer in a recent report by the CBC Fifth Estate in Canada, which is like their 60 Minutes. They identified Strassmeyer as having been in contact with the American CIA agent when he was in the United States, you know, making his way toward Oklahoma City, apparently through his father's connections at a very high level to people in the CIA in the U.S. That's interesting. It raises a lot of questions. There, some have alleged that Strassman may have played a very significant role in terms of McVeigh's life and the Oklahoma bombing. But it's something I think we want to get into in another program in detail, because you literally could spend an hour just sorting that one out.
And we're down to about the last 3 minutes here. Martin, I'd like to throw out some names. The whole question of Andreas Strassmeyer and some of his connections to officialdom on both sides of the Atlantic, perhaps elements of CIA here, certainly the CDU and mainstream German right in Germany. This connection between people who represent themselves as opposed to the government and the very government they represent themselves as opposed to is that is a much more fuzzy relationship than is often than it is often portrayed as being. Bernd Schmidt, the Solingen bombing, Kirk Lyons, and Dennis Mahone.
Well, you mentioned in terms of Kirk Lyons, he is a very key figure in the neo-Nazi scene in the U.S. He's an attorney. He is involved with setting up a group called CAUSE, which stands for Canada, Australia, United States, and South Africa, all countries that he feels the rights of civil rights of white people are being violated. He became sort of a CAUSE celebrity in the far right because he represented Louis Beam, who was one of the key figures in the Aryan Nations, when he was on trial for charges of sedition in 1988. But Dennis Mahone was a Ku Klux Klan leader in the United States. He's now associated with a group called WAR, the White Aryan Resistance, led by Tom Metzger, the skinhead guru, based in Southern California. Mahone himself is based in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He was invited to Germany. He went over there in 1991 and held a series of cross burnings throughout reunified Germany. So he had these connections to the German neo-Nazi scene, just as Kirk Lyons has had connections to the German neo-Nazi scene. And Bernd Schmidt was a person who provided, he was a key figure in the neo-Nazi scene in Germany. He is a German now, the other two are American. He provided security, essentially, for visiting dignitaries such as Kirk Lyons and Dennis Mahone when they came to visit Germany. And Bernd Schmidt, it turns out, had been an informant for German secret services, and he was some of his protégés, shall we say, from a martial arts club that he was the leader of, the teacher at, were directly implicated in the terrible bombing in Solingen in Germany, which killed several people in 1993.
That same sort of fuzzy boundary between people who represent themselves as opposed to the government and the very government they represent themselves as opposed to manifests itself in connection with Roy Frankhauser, a Pennsylvania Klansman you discuss.
Fascinating figure, Frankhauser. Very, very intelligent man in a lot of ways, but totally psychotic, in that Frankhauser was involved in several different white supremacist organizations, and he was close friends with Robert Miles, who was head of the Mountain Church in Michigan. And Miles himself was one of the ideologues involved with one of the leaders ideologically of the Aryan Nations. And Frankhauser was involved with the U.S. Nazi Party, with all these different Klan groups, and it turns out he was an informant for the FBI and the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau of the Treasury Department. He was also apparently undertook certain kind of covert operations for the National Security Council when Nixon was president. So here's a guy who was sort of playing both sides of the street, and yet even when it was exposed that he had been spying on the Nazi scene for the FBI, still his Nazi colleagues accepted him as one of his own. They didn't castigate him. They didn't say, oh, he's a traitor. They said, no, Frankhauser actually was spying on the FBI for us. So, you know, who knows where the truth begins and ends in a case like him. But he's a fascinating character. People that visited his house recently.
We're almost out of time, Mark.
Okay, well, we'll pick that up in another time. But he's a very interesting character. He appears in The Beast Reawakens.
And we will be returning to The Beast Reawakens when we resume, we'll be speaking with Martin A. Lee, the author of The Beast Reawakens, just published in hardcover by Little Brown Books. For Martin Lee, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.